This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Earl Scruggs is considered one of the most influential banjo players of all times. Back in the 1940s, he made a name for himself playing with Bill Monroe's band on the stage at the Grand Ole Opry. He popularized the so-called three-finger style, made famous in songs like Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Earl Scruggs got a start in rural North Carolina, grew up on a farm outside of Shelby, where he soaked up the sounds of the Piedmont. Joining us now is Gordon Castellnero. He is the co-author of a new biography about Earl Scruggs. The book includes more than 70 interviews called Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon. Gordon's going to be at the Earl Scruggs Center in Shelby this weekend, but first he joins me on the program. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank.
Let's talk a little bit about, we're going to talk about Earl Scruggs' life and legacy. Let's get right to this three-finger style, and maybe you can tell us more about it and what it compares to.
Well, the way the five-string banjo had always been played prior to Earl was kind of a frailing style or claw hammer. There was some two-finger picking that was around at the time, and in the Piedmont region of North Carolina, there was a very raw-sounding three-finger style, and it's that three-finger style that Earl gravitated towards. And what he ended up doing was greatly refining it. He smoothed it out. He incorporated syncopated roll patterns, the forward roll, the backward roll, and alternating thumb roll, and then another one that was later dubbed as the Foggy Mountain Roll, which is prominently heard at the beginning of Foggy Mountain Breakdown. But what he created with those syncopated rhythms was a perfect separation of notes, so every note could be heard clearly. And also, when it was sped up, it sounded like it was being played with machine gun precision. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing, too, is that he also emphasized the melody through this. And that really came about as the advice from his mother. His mother, when she was listening to Earl kind of showboat some hot licks, she said, you know, if you're going to play a tune, play it so it can be recognized. And that was one of the greatest pieces of advice that Earl had been given, because he then began to work on emphasizing the melody lines in his roll patterns.
All right, well, let's listen. I want to we'll play as an example the song Cripple Creek with Earl Scruggs to give you a sample of what that three-finger style sounds like. All right, there's Earl Scruggs performing the song Crippled Creek, and I'm talking to Gordon Castellnero, who is the author of a new biography called Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon. Gordon's going to be at the Scruggs Center in Shelby on Saturday. He's with me now. Tell us about his influences here in North Carolina and kind of how that style, whether or not it was played, because I know that he has he will talk about an influence on him, a guy named Snuffy Jenkins, who's also a North Carolinian.
Well, Snuffy Jenkins was one of his influences. There was a guy by the name of Smith Hammett, who was a relative, and there was a blind man by the name of Mac Woolbright. So these were all influences that he certainly soaked up. And, you know, again, he took their form of, I should also say, too, that his brother Junie played banjo as well, three-finger style, and was an influence, too. But he just took their styles and just made it his own, and just really created the standard that we all go by today. I think Steve Martin kind of said it best when he had said that prior to 1945, nobody had ever played the banjo like Earl, and after 1945, everybody played the banjo like Earl, or at least they tried to.
Well, let's listen to what would have been a more common style before that, and that would be called the clawhammer style. Before I listen to a clip and hear an example, Gordon, maybe I'll get you to describe what's going on with clawhammer style and how it differs from three-finger.
Thank you.
That's a clip of banjo player Wade Ward performing the song Old Joe Clark. I'm talking to Gordon Castellaro, the author of the new biography called Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon. So what was going on there? I mean, you can certainly hear the difference, but how? Tell me what's happening with the clawhammer style.
Well, that's played like you would pick a note with the thumb, and then you would kind of frail it, with the rest of your fingers. So it's almost kind of like a pick and a strum, a pick and a strum, and a pick and a strum, versus playing just picking the notes individually.
And that articulation, that three-finger style, as you say, he didn't really invent that style. Was it a regional thing? I mean, is it in the way that we can sort of identify a place for Delta blues and Piedmont blues and that sort of thing? Was three-finger something that was fairly popular in this part of the country?
Well, it was known in the Piedmont region, but certainly nobody knows really quite where it came from. And honestly, outside of the Piedmont region, it was virtually unheard. Nobody had ever heard of it. So when he first played that on the Grand Ole Opry on December 8th, 1945, it just blew everybody away because they had never heard the banjo quite played like that before.
Now, there's a story that he developed this three-finger style after a fight with his brother. Why don't you tell us that story?
Very serendipitously, I might add, too. He had a bit of an argument with his older brother, Horace, and so his mother separated the two of them, and Earl went into the front room, and as he had once described, he was pouting and picking. And he picked up the banjo. He had it in detuning, and he was trying to play the song Reuben. And somehow he started to incorporate his middle finger into it. And when he got it, he screamed, "I've got it!"
Don't know how coincidental that middle finger in the fight had to do with it, but what connection that had. But there it is. And of course, as you say, he didn't really invent it, but it's a style that was pretty popular. Earl and Horace also had an interesting method for working on their timing. Tell us that story.
They absolutely did. They would stand outside the front of their house back to back, kind of like two guys who are about ready to walk off to do a duel. And they would start the tune, and then they would walk around to the back of the house. And if they met up at the back of the house and they were in time, they knew they had their timing right. It's anyway. A very, very unusual method, but it certainly worked.
This is a hillbilly metronome, I think. It's pretty good stuff. So tell us, you mentioned Bill Monroe and hooking up with Bill Monroe and getting on the Grand Ole Opry, and this is 1945. Tell us how they made that connection.
Well, Bill Monroe had a banjo player in his group called Dave Stringbean Aikman. He was called Stringbean because of his height. And Stringbean played that clawhammer style. And then he left Monroe's band at the end of 1945. And Bill had asked his fiddle player, Jim Shoemate, if he knew anybody who could play the five-string banjo. And Jim Shoemate said, "Yes, I know a guy by the name of Earl Scruggs, but he doesn't play anything like Stringbean." Now, Shoemate had met Earl earlier in Hickory, North Carolina, where he had his own program on the radio. And Earl and a friend of his by the name of Grady Wilkie had stopped by. To see Jim's show and actually got up on stage and played. And when Jim saw the way Earl had played the banjo, he thought he was the greatest banjo player he had ever heard. So in December of 1945, Earl had been playing with a guy by the name of Lost John Miller in his band called Lost John Miller and the Allied Kentuckians. And Shoemate approached him to audition for Monroe, but Earl actually turned him down because he was quite happy with his spot in Shoemate's band. And shortly after he declined the audition with Monroe, Lost John said that he was disbanding, so now all of a sudden Earl needed a job, so he called Shoemate back and asked if he could do that audition. And so he met Bill Monroe and the rest of the boys at the Tulane Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. He played the songs Dear Old Dixie and Sally Gooden because he knew those were songs that Stringbean would have never played. And suffice to say, he was hired right away, and he made his debut with the Bluegrass Boys on December the 8th, 1945.
Obviously, the Bluegrass Boys had a reputation by then, or they wouldn't have been on the Grand Ole Opry. But mm-hmm. to what extent do you think it was Earl Scruggs who helped propel Bill Monroe to new heights from that point forward?
Well, just that very night, the performance that he did, he was received with a thunderous applause. Nobody had ever heard the banjo played quite like that. And it ended up being a topic of conversation for people for the entire next week. It also did a couple of things that need to be pointed out. He really just single-handedly transformed not only the way the banjo would be played, but also the perception that people had of the five-string banjo. The banjo had always kind of been associated with buffoons as a prop for their comedy. And so now all of a sudden it was looked upon as a very serious instrument. And the sales of banjos that had been in decline suddenly just skyrocketed, and that's all due in part to Earl. And in fact, when George D. Hay, who was the head of the Grand Ole Opry, who was known as the Solemn Old Judge, when he would introduce them at that point afterwards, instead of saying, "Here's Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys," he would say, "Here's Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and his fancy five-string banjo." So he certainly made an impression that forever changed the instrument.
That said, he decides to leave that band and move back to North Carolina. What was behind that decision?
Well, he had become, I guess you could say, unsatisfied with his life as a professional musician. These guys were playing venues 6 days a week, sometimes seven, and they would travel on these rural highways, all of them crammed into a car together with all of their instruments. And you can imagine driving those rural highways in the hot summertime, no air conditioning. And he was making $60 a week, and Monroe also never paid any kind of per diem. So, they were forced to pay for their own hotel rooms. And so Earl had just become very disheartened by it all and decided, it was time for him to go back into just regular work. He was going to go back to his previous job at the Lily Mills Thread Factory. And when he quit Monroe, band, Bill Monroe had said to him, "The name Earl Scruggs will never be heard from again."
Ooh.
And yeah, boy, was he wrong about that.
Yeah.
And so and during the time, during the 2 weeks that Earl had played with Monroe, Monroe never gave him any kind of eye contact, didn't speak a word to him. And he did a show with Roy Acuff. Right before he went back to North Carolina, Acuff offered Earl a job at More Money, but Earl's mind was made up. He said nope. Right. He was going back to working in a thread mill. And then strangely enough, after he had left, he got a phone call from another member of the band by the name of Lester Flatt. And Lester Flatt had joined Bill Monroe's band earlier that year in 45 in the spring. And Lester was also a mill worker, and he had said that, I know neither one of us really wants to go back to mill work. Why don't we give music another shot by forming our own band? And Lester offered to come to North Carolina so Earl wouldn't have to travel, and they started there.
Started there, and they recorded a few songs, including a little number called Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Earl Scruggs, Lester Flatt performing Foggy Mountain Breakdown. I'm talking to Gordon Castelnero, who has co-authored a new biography called Earl Scruggs, Banjo Icon. And you can catch Gordon at the Earl Scruggs Center in Shelby on Saturday. That song really does it for bluegrass, right? I mean, that's a transformative song in the history of music, is it not, Gordon?
Well, that's become the anthem of the five-string banjo, you could say, that came about in 1949. That particular recording was at the end of 1949, and it really was born out of a tune called Bluegrass Breakdown, which is closely associated with Bill Monroe. Earl had composed Bluegrass Breakdown during his time with Monroe, but he never got any credit for the song at all. Monroe was the boss, and he took full credit for it, and nobody really knows if he had actually added or contributed anything to it, but the song was Earl's. And so what Earl ended up doing was reworking a Bluegrass Breakdown, and he just did it by substituting one chord. He took out the F chord in Bluegrass Breakdown and substituted it with a E minor. And E minor is the very prominent chord that you hear all throughout the tune. And boy, what a world of difference it made.
And it certainly is a song that we know, and it played heavily in, obviously became practically the theme song for the movie Bonnie and Clyde. And there's actually a story about how that song worked its way into the film, right?
Yes. There's a guy by the name of Pete Kai Kendall. He ended up becoming the editor of Bluegrass Unlimited, and he went to high school with Warren Beatty. And while Pete Kai Kendall and Warren Beatty were not friends or associates in high school, they were in the same civics class. And as Kai Kendall had told the story, he had said that they did a what do you want to do after high school kind of a day. And his dream was to be a hillbilly disc jockey. So he brought in some records and he played them for the class. And one of them was that 1949 version of Foggy Mountain Breakdown. And immediately after the class was over, Warren Beatty pulled him aside and started asking him all kinds of questions about the music. And it obviously made such an impression on him that when it came time to score the music for Bonnie and Clyde, he had actually reached out to Earl Scruggs and asked him to compose the score for it. And before Earl could even pen a note for it, Beatty had called him back and said, you know, never mind, I found something in my music library that I think will work out just fine. And it was Earl's 49 version of Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Talking about the life and legacy of Earl Scruggs today on The State of Things. Author Gordon Castelnaro is with me. The book is Earl Scruggs' Banjo Icon. And, of course, the other tune that we all know from that collaboration of Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs is what has become the theme of the theme song for the Beverly Hillbillies, right? The Ballad of Jed Clampett. What's the story behind it?
Well, the story behind that was Paul Henning, who had created the series The Beverly Hillbillies, was in dire need of a theme song. None of his music writers were giving him anything that he was interested in. And he just kind of had his own little idea on how the song should go. Henning was not a composer by any means. But he just kind of sang it out, what he had heard in his head, to a piano player friend of his who wrote the music for it. And then he went to the Ash Grove Coffee House to see some performances by Flatt and Scruggs, who were appearing there at that time. And he thought, these are the guys who need to do the theme. And when he approached it to them, it was actually kind of turned down. Louise Scruggs, who was managing the boys, was a little bit concerned about the title of the show, Beverly Hillbillies. She didn't know what kind of connotation, the hillbillies were going to have, and how they were going to be depicted. Because certainly, she didn't want the boys to be associated with anything that was going to be demeaning to hillbillies. So Paul Henning assured her that the way the show goes is that the hillbillies always outsmart the city slickers. And he sent them a copy of the pilot. They watched it and then agreed, sure, they would do it. And the actual arrangement for it was done by Earl. He created the whole way the song would go with his banjo being the forefront of it. And then afterwards, Louise thought, that would make a great single for Columbia Records. So she approached Perry Botkin, who was the music director for the Beverly Hillbillies, and then later went to Paul Henning. They agreed, and it was recorded. And on December the 8th, 1962, the very day that they were playing Carnegie Hall, which was being recorded also for a live album, the Ballad of Jed Clampett hit number one on the country charts.
My guest is Gordon Castelnaro. He is the author of the new book about Earl Scruggs called Earl Scruggs' Banjo Icon. He's going to be at the Earl Scruggs Center in Shelby on Saturday afternoon. Gordon, what a pleasure. Great story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
We've got links to the book and more of his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a novel about a boy's troubled upbringing in an Appalachian town reflects the experiences of author Philip Lewis, and you'll hear about it on The State of Things. Stay tuned.